Following is a Dharma talk by Pandit Bhikkhu, who is based in Bangkok and can be found at littlebang.org.
So, hello everybody. Do you all know Seinfeld? Do you remember the sketch he did with the alien who comes down and he sees the Americans? And he sees the people walking their dogs. And usually the dogs are kind of pulling on the lead and you have a metal chain and you're holding the chain. And every so often the dog will poo and the human being goes picks it up. And Seinfeld said if aliens came down to Earth and saw that, they would assume that the dogs are in charge. This is a highly relevant story to the topic that we're going to talk about tonight. I first wanted to ask, what happened in your mind during the meditation?
I went a lot of places and I had to
look back. Okay. Why do you think the mind went into a lot of places when you told it to stay still? That's probably a bit too difficult for your question. But.
There's just a lot of things on my mind, I guess.
Okay. Do you normally consider yourself like someone who can control their mind and you're reasonably ordered and rational? And
yeah.
Anyone else want to report what was actually just happening right now in the mind? Too ashamed? Over here. Okay.
I just felt like a leaf riding the waves of the ocean, spinning and enjoying that, and then just getting pulled up into a rainbow's light.
Cool. Was there any thinking going on?
No, just riding.
Just riding.
Like with everything.
Cool. Okay, so we have a religion that is based around something we don't know about, which is quite an interesting premise. But we start off with the idea of enlightenment. And this is something that, if we haven't been told, if we haven't heard about it, then it's not something that will crop up in most people's minds. So to be very few people are able to attain to enlightenment without having been taught. Those people are called Pacheka Buddhas. People who are enlightened by their own efforts and not through a teaching of another. This is the mythology we don't have to take too seriously. Those who are enlightened by themselves, but not through a teaching from other people. And they're called Pacheka Buddhas. And one of the characteristics is they can't teach. Once they become enlightened, once they discover this, whatever it is, we might call the summum bonum, or the highest good. Once they discover that, whatever it is, they can't teach to other people. One can imagine that maybe they can teach some people some things. It doesn't have to be absolute. But I guess because they haven't used the system to come to this understanding, then it's very hard for them to give a system to other people. There are arahants who are those who have heard a teaching and they've practiced accordingly and become enlightened. These are called Anubuddhas. And then there is a Sammasambuddha, which is a perfectly enlightened being. And a perfectly enlightened being is different because, according to the mythology, they've gone through many lifetimes, practicing from lifetime to lifetime different qualities of character, until eventually they've perfected every quality of character that is possible to correct. So the mythology goes. Remember, with stories, with ancient stories, we don't always have to take the stories in a literal way. Stories were never meant to be factual records. That's just something that we've come up with in recent times. Even Shakespeare, I mean, he based a lot of his characters on historical characters, but he was not trying to give history lessons. I mean, his version of King John was very different to the actual King John that lived. Stories were meant to pass on a piece of information. They're supposed to illustrate something. So we can take this story of Sammasambuddha going through many, many lifetimes as an illustration of somebody who has perfected every quality of character. Now, whether that means they've perfected every quality of character over lifetimes or over just one lifetime, just being here, then it's not too important. The point is that they've developed all of these qualities. So then when they do become enlightened, they have the charisma, they have the intelligence, they have the wisdom, and I like to think they have the charm to teach other people. And this is why they have many, many disciples. If you're interested in the mythology, there's one curious addition to this, and that is that there are different kinds of Sammāsambuddha also. Some of the Sammāsambuddhas are enlightened through faith. These are the lesser Buddhas. Some are enlightened through wisdom. This is our Buddha, Sakyamuni Buddha, whose teachings we have. This is the middle level. But the highest level is those who are Sammāsambuddhas who are enlightened through effort or heroic struggle. It's called viriya. And this will be the greatest kind of Buddha. If you're a Buddha and you become enlightened through heroic struggle, then you will have a great influence on mankind. And supposedly our Buddha did say that where I have 100 disciples, Maitreya Buddha, who is the next one, will have 1,000 disciples. I'm not sure if that's just because when Maitreya Buddha comes back, they'll have internet and he can reach more people. Maybe that's what. So there's just a bit of the mythology around Buddhism that's quite relevant to our topic this evening, which is called Small Acts of Resistance, but really is a talk about ego, what the ego is, how it works, whether it's any good for you or not, and where it fits into Buddhism. So when we come to do meditation, usually what we find is you sit down and we say to the mind, right, stay still, stay with the object of meditation, stay with the breathing. And usually what happens is the mind has other ideas and it decides that it's going to go thinking about stuff, or it's going to go imagining something, or it's going to get caught up in some kind of fantasy or line of thinking. And the last thing that it does is come back to this plain, simple, boring meditation object that you've given it. The Buddha had a very nice little story to exemplify this. And he said, imagine a king of a kingdom saying to somebody, you're banished out of my kingdom. We don't want you here anymore. And the man says, stuff you, I'm not going. Now, if that king is really the king, he will have the man banished, and the man will not be able to stay in the kingdom. But if that man says, stuff you, and stays on in the kingdom, what does that mean? It means that the first guy actually wasn't the king. He just thought he was the king. Now, in those days, all analogies were about kings and this kind of thing. So to modernize the analogy a little bit, maybe you've worked in a company, and the boss has gone away on holiday, and then there's always somebody, some member of staff, who when the boss is away, they think that they're the one in charge. Right? Have you had this? And they usually walk around barking orders, like do this, do that, as if they're the boss of the company. I've experienced this a few times myself, and one guy who's a German, not that that's relevant, and the boss went away and he thought he was in charge and he came around barking orders, and I just said no. And he said, no, you have to do it, I'm in charge. And I said, no, you're not. And then I called him something which I'm not going to repeat. He thought he was the boss because the boss is away. He thinks he's in charge and he's not. And whatever he tells us to do, we don't have to do. That means that he's not the boss. So in the same way, the Buddha gave this analogy that when you tell your mind to do something and it doesn't do it, when it has different ideas, this shows that you're not in control of your mind. You think that you're in control. You think that you're the leader. But in actual fact, if that was true, you could say to yourself, I'm just going to follow the breathing. It doesn't matter what visions, what feelings, what thoughts arise. It doesn't matter. I'm just going to be with the feeling of the breath. Fact is, the feeling of the breath is quite boring. It's not that absorbing. And so you get bored of it quite quickly. You'd much rather have some other experience coming up. And many people, when they come to meditation, they come and they want to experience peace and quiet. And there's just so many people in my house, and I just want to like have peace for a little while. And I just have so many things that, you know, my business, I just want to have peace. Of course, that's how we advertise all the retreat and things, find peace of mind. But of course, it doesn't happen. You sit down and the mind has other ideas. It goes off in other directions. What you're experiencing when this happens is a fundamentally different way of looking at the mind. In normal run of the daily life, you go around thinking that you're in charge, thinking that you're the boss, you're making the decisions. Now, in meditation, you're experiencing the mind not as the boss or not as the person in charge, but as something really annoying, as an irritating member of staff that thinks he's in charge. And this is a very, very different way of viewing yourself, viewing your being. In fact, it gets quite confusing then, because who's in charge? Who said sit down and meditate? Wasn't that the same mind? Wasn't that the same guy that is now refusing to meditate? So it gets quite confusing. Right? Who is in charge? Where is the ego? Where is the self? These are the kind of insights that start to arise. And of course, you wanted peace. You wanted thunderbolts and lightning or things, but what you get is you start to see this imposter that has been ruling your mind, and you start to see it in that light as an imposter. This is why we call this kind of meditation insight meditation, because you're gaining insight into the nature of your own body and mind. So it gets a little confusing about all you really know. All you can really tell then is that what you do is go chasing after what's nice. And this is basically the role of this thinker or this commentator, this feeler, this mind that jumps around from thing to thing. It chases after what, in the present moment, it thinks is going to be nice. And to be fair, that's got you by so far. I mean, you're not bad. You're in a reasonable position. You're a reasonably good person. You have a shelter over your head. But deeply, emotionally, spiritually, chasing after what is nice is not ultimately very satisfactory. It's not a very intelligent way to live. I can give you an example. Chimpanzees. Some experiments. Chimpanzees, you may not know this, but they're very fond of peanut M&Ms, as we all are. And when you're training chimpanzees, one way that you can train them to do things is to reward them with peanut M&Ms. So if you get the behavior response that you like, you give them peanut M&Ms, and very quickly they learn how to do this. So one way you can do it is you can hold some pebbles in one hand and one single pebble in the other hand. And you allow the chimpanzee to choose a hand. Soon gets hold of the game, soon gets hold of it, it's going to have to choose one of these two hands. If the chimpanzee chooses one pebble, you give it a handful of M&Ms, right? If the chimpanzee holds the hand that has several pebbles in it, you give the chimpanzee one M&M, right? So after a little while of training, what do you think the monkey does when you give it the two hands? Naturally, it's going to choose the hand with the one pebble, right? Clear enough, easy to understand. What happens if you change the rule? Now, you've already trained it this way, so it knows the rules of the game. But if you change it a little bit, and in this hand you have one M&M, and in this hand you have a handful of M&Ms, but the same rules apply. If it chooses the hand with the one M&M, it gets a handful. If it chooses the hand with lots of M&Ms, it only gets one. Now what does the monkey do? Which hand does it choose? The one with a lot. Why does it choose the one with a lot of M&Ms? It knows the rules of the game.
Visualization.
The abstract vision of this reward isn't as strong as the concrete visualization of a handful of M&Ms. You're quite right. This is what happens every time. This poor monkey, like, it knows which hand it's got to choose. It knows what it's got to do. Just as it goes to do it, it goes, "No, I want the M&Ms," and it will grab the fistful of M&Ms. This is the natural tendency of a human being and of all animals. We chase after that thing that is looks nicest, that in the present moment seems to be something that's going to give us the reward. So when while we're sitting here, we think about meditation, and that appears as a reward. But then as you sit, you don't get that much of a reward, do you? Like, for a few minutes, the breathing is quite nice, and then let's see, it's boring. See, you're not getting much of a reward, and then thinking about winning the lottery suddenly seems like a more interesting reward that you're going to get, or visualizing some beautiful light in front of you, or even getting absorbed into a really good mantra or something like that. This starts to appear as something more enticing. So what the mind does is it just follows after that which is enticing to it right in the present moment. Once it's picked something up, it very quickly gets bored with it, whatever it is. I was giving this example the other day of Jerry Seinfeld and his Porsches. He was very keen on Porsches. When the TV series picked up, he was able to buy a Porsche, and that gave him happiness. So he bought another one, and that added to his happiness, but not as much as the first one presumes. So he bought a third to shore up the lack of the feeling in the second one that wasn't quite up to the standard of the first. Until he had more than 90 of these things. And not blaming him, he's a good person, he does stuff for charity, he's a nice guy, he's got the money, so why not? I mean, I don't want to hold him up as some kind of evil character that should be saving mankind, but instead he's buying Porsches. That's his money, his choice, he's a nice guy, he's earned it in a good way. But whatever you do, whatever you put the mind onto, has what economists call the law of diminishing marginal returns. So each extra one you get is going to give you less pleasure. If you eat a Mars bar right now, it's very nice. Let's say a fun-size Mars bar. But you eat a second one, and it's not quite as nice as a third one. And if you keep going... Actually, there's an English guy who made a documentary about this, and he surveyed English people what thing in the world gave them the most pleasure. And it wasn't what you think it is. It was actually chocolate came out on top. When they surveyed like thousands of people, chocolate came out on top. So he got a bunch of volunteers and sat them in the room with like a big pile of chocolate and said, keep going. And of course, within 15 minutes, they're like... And one imagines they were turned off chocolate for life. Because he kept saying, another one, have another one, have another one. You may have seen The Meaning of Life. Have you seen that film, Meaning of Monty Python? And the exploding fat man. And it's just this enormous man, and he has this enormous meal, and he's eaten everything that could possibly be eaten, and he's grown visibly in dimensions. And he's just like nothing more. He's eaten everything, and the rest he can't have any more. And I think it's John Cleese who comes to him, and he says, how about just a nice little mint? He eats the mint, and he explodes. This is the law of diminishing marginal returns. And the same happens when you do meditation. If you put the mind onto the breathing for a few minutes, it's quite nice. And then, you know, after a short while, some other thought pops up and that becomes more interesting. Now, this thought that pops up, as we're willing to disengage from it and come back to the meditation object, you start to hear it literally talking in your head. Wouldn't it be nice if I had a Porsche as well? You know, wouldn't it be nice if I had this? What's for dinner? Did I leave the stove on before I left? What time have I got to get up tomorrow? I don't think I'm coming to Dharma talks on Friday nights. I think I just want to get enlightened on Tuesdays rather than Fridays. When there's not so many other interesting things to do, I could be out with the guys watching sports. I could be at home. Watching, well, I don't know even what's on Fridays. And you have so many channels now that it could be anything on, right? When I was a kid in England, we had three channels, and one of those was rubbish. You know, BBC Two was like, forget it. So you had BBC and ITV. And ITV had the good stuff, but it had all these adverts, you know. BBC wasn't so good, but you didn't have all the adverts. So there's always better stuff on a Friday night. So this thought arises, this commentator, and starts talking to you. But when you're doing the meditation, you can literally hear it saying stuff. You know, I want to go here, I'd rather have that, wouldn't it be nice if? And then sometimes I remember, oh, I'm supposed to be meditating. All right, I'll meditate in a minute. I just want to finish this thought on, and then it's gone off in this other direction. So you're literally experiencing yourself as a schizophrenic, right? With schizophrenia, one theory that I personally subscribe to with schizophrenia is the mind will tend, with a normal person, will focus on one thing at a time. So while you're focusing on what you can hear, you're not focusing on your thoughts. If you focus on your thoughts, you can't feel the feelings in your big toe. If you focus your mind onto your big toe, you're not tasting the taste in your mouth, etc. With some people, it seems that their attention is split and they experience two or three things at a time, at the same time, with the same degree of vividness. So no matter what they put their feeling of self on, there's always some other thing that seems to be going, and this is why they have the feeling of being completely out of control. So very often they claim that gods or demons or devils or other people are thinking thoughts for them. So you're seeing yourself in this manner too. This commentator runs away with all this stuff. And normally you just believe it, you follow it. But if you practice this awareness, what you start to see is the commentator usually commentates after the fact. So I would watch myself and I'll say, right, I think I'll go and have a cup of tea now, because I'm English, you know. By the time I get to, right, I think I will, by the time I get this far through the sentence, I realize that I've already got up and I'm already aimed towards the kettle before I've even finished thinking that thought. So what you see is the thought comes after the fact. This commentator who says all these things to you is actually not the boss. That wasn't the decision. You've already made the decision. You're already moving in that direction. But this guy starts thinking, I think I'll go make a cup of tea now. Pretending that it was his idea all along, you know. It's one way kids used to, you know, antagonize other people. You know, they order you to do something you're already doing. So we start to watch this process and watch this thought. I can't stand another minute with this aching knee. And then you start questioning it because you've been sitting here with the aching knee for 15 minutes. But it's only when this commentator comes up and makes a comment on it that you start to really believe it. You know, when's he going to ring the bell? And I have a machine now, it rings the bell for me. And you catch this thought coming up, and you're like, a second ago, it didn't really matter when the bell rings. Now this commentator has come up and said something to me, and I'm believing it, and I'm following after it. This is viewing the mind in the sense of the non-self. Now, this commentator is what most people vaguely refer to as the ego. And ego, as we'll come to see in a few minutes, is not part of the Buddhist paradigm. We don't have this idea of ego in Buddhism. Now, we can certainly use the idea of an ego, but we should really understand ego in the original context in which ego was presented by Freud. So the common idea of an ego is as a controller, is a sense of self-aggrandizement, which is what I call it. You want to make yourself look bigger, look better in front of other people. There's a test done on this with the students are all strangers to each other, and they were sent into a room and told to have a 10-minute conversation on film, end of instruction. That's all they had to do. So they go into the room, they have a 10-minute conversation, they know it's being filmed, and then they come back out, and then they're shown the film of their conversation, but they're asked to note how many times in that 10-minute conversation they told a lie. And it was quite a lot. If you were speaking, basically you lied every 2 or 3 minutes. I mean, even going down to the little simple white lies. And the students all reported utter, most of these experiments, by the way, when you hear about them, you all think, I wouldn't be like that. I wouldn't do that. The fact is you would be exactly the same. Quick quiz. Who told more lies, the men or the women? Huh? The men. Okay. Any other opinions? Equal. About the same.
Four. Women speak three to four words per week. Four that men speak.
So theoretically, they're going to tell more lies because they said more. Right. Okay. Anybody else have an opinion? Okay, it was actually about equal. Men and women told lies to about the same level, same degree, but there was a difference in the lies that they told. The women would tell lies to the other person to make them feel good. You know, oh, that's a beautiful top, that's, you look nice, that's, oh, that's so interesting. But the men would tell lies to make themselves look good. This is the ego, this is the sense of self-aggrandizement that we usually associate with the term ego, with the idea of an ego. I had one example of this when I was younger. I went on a skiing holiday with my father, one of my father's friends. And I was like 16 and they were like ancient. yeah, they're probably in their 50s, I guess, at this point. So when we got on the skiing holiday, they tested how good you were at skiing and split you up into groups. And you had like the newbie group, and then you had group one. Group two were not bad. Group three were pretty damn good. And group four were the experts. I was in group three, which is pretty damn good, though I say so myself. And my father's friend was in group two. Okay. And we went through the, I think, 10 days or something we were skiing. We all improved and we had a good time. And we were in our classes in the morning and then you could do what you want in the afternoon. And then at the end of it, we had a competition. And we had a slalom race and it was timed of, you know, your time of doing this race. And I came about halfway in my group, which is not bad, 50%, something like that. My father's friend came, you know, in the top 20% of his group. But it turns out that his group, the best in his group, group two, actually beat the best in the group three. And boy, did he keep telling us about it. He kept on and on and on. And like, he'd always, all night, he was finding some new way to introduce the, well, you know, like, people in our group, you know, even the ones only partway through, we were beating the ones in the group three. And he was telling it to me all the time. This ego, I want to be recognized for the fact that I'm in my 50s and I beat you and you're just a 16-year-old whippersnapper squirt and I was better than you are. And then I asked my dad, why does he keep bringing it up? And yes. And my dad said he's bringing it up because he's trying to make himself look good. And this seems to me like a bit crazy. Like, if you're a grown man, what are you doing playing these stupid... I didn't give a stuff. I really didn't care who won. I just had a nice skiing trip, met some people, we had a good time, and that was it. That was as far as I thought. I wasn't in competition with anyone else. This sense of self-aggrandizement is what we usually think of when we talk about ego. However, in original Freudian psychology, that wasn't what ego meant. And somehow the common view of what an ego is has kind of become usurped. And really, we just use it to stick on a quality of a person that we don't like, so it's egotistical, without really having a strong idea of what ego is or what it means. In Freudian psychology, the id was that which seeks pleasure, operated according to the pleasure principle. So, like the chimpanzees would reach for the handful of M&Ms, the id is that drive that makes you simply get what you want. And supposedly we learn this when we're a baby, because we have an unpleasant feeling and we cry and we want the mother or father to get rid of the unpleasant feeling for us. We feel hungry and we cry and then we get fed and then we're happy. My friend has a baby. I mean, I don't know anything about these things, but he had a baby that was crying and he was kind of bouncing the baby up and down. And I said, don't you think that bouncing the baby up and down and patting it on the back is going to make it worse. And he said, no, it just needs to fart. He just needs to break wind. He didn't say break wind, he said fart. And this baby is crying and crying and crying, and he's bouncing it up and down, and then the baby was like, ah, nice, and settled straight down. I was actually quite amazed that a parent can read that much in a child, and a little horrified as well, to be honest. But that child just wanted that faint, not very unpleasant feeling of the wind building up was enough to make the child cry. This is the pleasure principle. All it wants is to be placated and mollified. However, as the child starts to grow up, the parents start introducing rules, and you will get the pleasure if you do as you're told. One of the first things is potty training. So you're allowed to poo and pee in this place, but not at other places. So originally you can do it any way you want, but now you have rules, and you get praised if you do it in the right place, and you get blamed if you do it in the wrong place. Now Freud, as crusty and Germanic and obnoxious and egotistical as he was also a very, very sharp observer of human beings. And nobody had observed children and babies really like he had, and started to see what kind of stresses and strains children had. As the children then, they learn these rules, they learn what is called the rational principle. Even though I want to do something, I will not do that thing. Even though I don't want to do something, I will do that thing. And this is called acting according to the rational principle. And this is what Freud called the ego. See? So the ego is actually, certainly in Freudian psychology, the ego is a good thing. The ego is something that should be developed and should be properly functioning. Freud said, we have to accept that most modern psychologists do not agree with what Freud said. So psychology has come a long way from Freud's original theories. But Freud said that if you introduce trauma or stress or problems at these early ages while the child is developing in these ways and learning all these rules, then later on their ego is malformed, maladjusted ego. And this will be more like what we call egotistical. It's somebody with a badly functioning ego. If you didn't have an ego, that would be impossible in Freudian psychology. You couldn't not have an ego. If you didn't have an ego, you'd be like a pet cat. I mean, that's an example. Saying that, all the cats I've ever had have had big egos. You know, you'd be like a simple animal, like a dog. Cats may be able to manipulate you emotionally, but then they don't have strong rational principles. I saw this great article in The Onion, if ever you read that. Anyone read The Onion? It's a kind of spoof magazine. It said, dog in Wisconsin has the happiest day of its life for the 400th day on the run. Just to finish off, in Freudian psychology, then you have the superego, which is basically ideals, where you give up even the rational principle you would give up in pursuit or in honor of an even deeper principle. Things like honor or serving your country, things like this. So the two important ones were the id and the ego. Now, Freudian psychology is not in vogue currently. Psychology has come a long way from it. However, this particular principle really does work. And if you go to that one source where you can prove anything about human nature, is all there now on this one beautiful source that we have called YouTube. And you look up the marshmallow test. Anyone seen that? You've seen that one? Anyone else? They get a little kid in a bare blank room with blank walls. In the room is a bare table and a chair and a marshmallow. Okay? And the kid sits on they sit the kid on the chair and they say, we're going to leave the room now. If you want to eat the marshmallow, you can. no problem. But if when we come back you haven't eaten the marshmallow, we'll give you two marshmallows. And then they leave, and there's a secret camera filming the kid. It's hilarious. It's really funny. You watch these kids, and they're absolutely tortured. There's nothing else in the room except this pink inviting marshmallow, and they just really want to eat it. And many of them pick it up, and they sniff it, and they lick it, and they put it back down, and then they press it. Some of them kind of scoop bits out the middle and eat that, but put it back. Some of them put it in their ear, because they can't put it in their mouth, so they try putting it in their ear and up their nose. And they squish it, and they smell it again, and they put it down, and they're tortured. And this is the pleasure principle and the rational principle right in front of you on video, fighting within this child. So you can see, whether you like Freud's theory or not, you can actually see it in these children while they're in this experiment. And they're very cute, nice kids, so I would recommend you look up the marshmallow test. And there's quite a lot of variations on it and themes on it that they tried to play with. Now, in Buddhism, there isn't this concept of the ego. There isn't a concept that I have a self or an egotistical self. We have a teaching of self and non-self. But some people mistake that to mean you have an ego, and non-self means you've got to get rid of the ego. That was not the teaching. The teaching originally was there wasn't a self to begin with. It's not like you have a self and you've got to get rid of it. It's just the self wasn't there to begin with. What you do have in Buddhism is qualities. And we always look at a human being not as an integrated self or a person or an ego. We look at a human being as a collection of qualities. So very often when the monks would be blamed for something in the suttas, and in the Vinaya especially, which is the stories of the monks' rules. The Vinaya is where you see all the monks getting up to mischief. The suttas is where everything's perfect and holy and, you know, everything happens right. The Vinaya is where everything's going wrong. And so when a monk does something wrong, what you would see is they would go to this monk and say, "Venerable sir, this quality in you is blameworthy." But they would never say, "Venerable sir, you are blameworthy because you have this quality." So there's a slight difference there. The quality of character would be blameworthy, but you would never take that to be blaming the person. They didn't really have a concept of an integrated person to begin with. It was more you have a collection of qualities that you follow, that you train yourself in. Certain qualities are worthy and certain qualities are not worthy. Kusala, akusala is the word, skillful or unskillful, wholesome or unwholesome. So in this sense too, in Buddhism, the ego or these qualities were something that was to be developed according to the rational principle. One of the qualities was wisdom. So the wisdom is supposed to be there governing in a rational way all of these qualities. And without this rational principle governing, then it would be impossible to practice Dhamma. So now we have this sense of ego, this sense of self then arises with the commentator when you start saying things. This is what we feel to be the self. If you start to watch it in this way, you see that this commentator isn't the real self. The commentator comments on things that you've already decided. It claims to be making an action that you were already doing in the first place. It tells you that you can't stand things that 5 seconds ago you could stand perfectly well. It tells that you really hate something that 10 seconds ago you didn't care about. Have you ever been talking to somebody and felt, "I can't stand this person"? Right? If you hear it as a voice coming up, you realize that a second ago you were standing that person quite well. They were all right. They have some nice qualities and some unnice qualities, just like anyone. It's not an integrated whole of a person and you're just talking to them, and then the thought comes up, "I can't stand them," and the next thing, "I've got to get away, I've got to remove myself from this person." Have you ever found yourself saying, "This person's fantastic"? Yeah, less reaction when I say that. Why is that? Sometimes you decide that you like someone and then they do something really stupid and really horrible. Now, you see, what's going on is we're friends. So then even when you say something unnice, you still have that body of friendship that carries you over it. So you can do the same when you hear that thought come up that you dislike somebody. You can say also, you know, you can have this body of loving kindness or patience with other people that will carry you over the unwholesome qualities that you see in other people. All of this is catching that voice, catching that commentator, catching that voice that says, I like this, I can't stand that, I've got to go there, I can't do this, I look great in that, but I don't look good in this, and I'm getting so old, and nobody likes me, I'm not worthy, I am worthy, I'm fantastic, everybody likes me. All of these crazy voices, these crazy, egotistical, commentating voices that go on in your head. This kind of thought then, if you're going to try to control it, because this ego thinks that it's the controller. If you were to try and control the controller, how's that going to work? How is the ego going to control the ego? What is created by ego will be more ego. What is created by self will be more self. What is created by your impression of how you want yourself to be is going to be more self. I did, in my course as a wannabe psychologist, there was one lady and her husband said that she controlled him. And so she said that she made him into a better person. But after she'd made him into a better person, she didn't like him anymore. And I'm not sure how true that is. That's how the story comes to us. But that is how the ego will be. If you're going to create new commentator, new views and opinions, a new self out of your old self, what you wind up with is a self that's not that good anymore anyway. I was always sure that I would be okay if I could just sit still for an hour. I felt if I could just meditate for an hour, then I'll be great. And then I remember the first time I sat still for 3 hours and then I'm still not great. And really, I thought that if I can attain to this and attain to this, then everything will be right. It's never going to be right. Anything that you're creating with a sense of self, personality, is just going to be more self and more personality. That's also going to come up short when you've attained to it. So there was a famous Zen monk to illustrate this principle, which is a little tricky to get hold of, but to illustrate this principle, he's a man, one of the patriarchs of Zen, and his name was Hui Jiang. And I call him Hui Jiang, which is a little joke in Thai. And Hui Jiang came and saw his disciple, Matsu. And he said to Matsu, what are you doing? Matsu was meditating. He said to Matsu, what are you doing? And he said, I'm practicing my qualities so that I can attain to Buddhahood. And Hui Jiang said, great. And then he went off and he came back and he had a brick and a piece of cloth. And he was rubbing the brick. And Matsu said to Hui Jiang, what are you doing? And he said, I'm polishing this brick because I need a mirror. And Matsu said, it doesn't matter how long you polish the brick, you will never create a mirror. And Hui Jiang said, it doesn't matter how long you train your mind, you will never attain to Buddhahood. Now, that doesn't mean Buddhahood is, or arahantship, enlightenment is not attainable. What it means is, if you're just going to try and control and correct this controlling ego, this controlling self, you're never going to get beyond the controlling ego and the controlling self. The meditation, then, is not about trying to control this commentator. The meditation is of seeing your way through it, seeing yourself out of it. When you practice sitting meditation and you hear thoughts come up and you stick with them and you see them disappear, and then you see that really they're not that important. This commentator is an imposter. He, she, or it claims to be in control and it's not really in control. And when you see these thoughts ceasing as much as you see them arising, you've got space away or apart from this controlling ego. So this is why the ego is never going to get you enlightened. And this makes it a little tricky because who's doing the practice, who's doing the sitting? But it's seeing past this commentator, seeing the silence that is around this commentator. This is what starts to enable you to really change in a way that isn't just another form of control. So the main practice, putting space around the thoughts, hearing the thoughts in the non-self aspect. Okay, this is a tricky practice, and it takes a long time, and it takes a lot of patience. When you first start to practice, you really want to do it with your ego. You really want to make yourself sit for an hour or 2 hours. You really want to control, and you can't. This is just more of your ego stuff. But bit by bit, you see your way around it. You see the spaces in between it. You start to view it in the non-self aspect, and then you stop believing the thoughts. You stop believing the commentator. It tells you all kinds of rubbish, really. The commentator will lead you into all kinds of trouble, make you go building hovercrafts and all kinds of things that you really don't need. Now, this doesn't mean that you don't do anything. You still carry on as you normally would. Real meditator, the people around you should not really be able to tell any different. You should be carrying on with your life in exactly the same way that you were before. Externally, there shouldn't be very much difference to a meditator or a non-meditator. Hopefully, over time, you become a little less egotistical, a little more patient. But really, internally, there's a very vast difference. There's a big change. So this is a difficult practice. It's a burden. It's a job to do, and it takes a long time to train. Buddha said there are two kinds of fool in the world. One who shoulders a burden he should not shoulder, and one who does not shoulder the burden that he should shoulder. And most of us are shouldering all kinds of burdens that really we do not need to shoulder. And we don't shoulder this burden of going past ourselves because we're so attached to, so in love with ourselves. There are two kinds of people in this world, those who split the world into two kinds of people and those who don't. So, small acts of resistance was the title of the talk. And what I mean by that then is a great act of resistance is going to be more ego, more self. I'm going to be a meditator. I'm going to go on a retreat. I want the strictest, hardest, longest retreat with the best teacher. This kind of thing. These are great acts of resistance which are never going to help you. The small acts of resistance, seeing through one thought, seeing one deluded thought coming up telling you stuff, and then you question, do I have to believe that thought or not? This is a very small act of resistance, but these are the things that will take you towards enlightenment. I actually have a book from Stephen Smith that I borrowed off him called Small Acts of Resistance. And I don't know if anyone's read it. It's actually quite a good book. And it lists many times and many places around the world where a few small things that somebody has done has brought down a nation or a dictator. One of them was in Poland when the Russians were controlling the TV news channel. And so everyone boycotted TV. And when the news came on, they turned off their TV and they went out into the streets. And this small act of resistance started to snowball. And the Russian military was unable to stop everybody just going out onto the street while this party political news program was on. And this snowballed into Poland gaining independence or semi-independence from Russia. So, small acts of resistance is hearing this thought coming up and being willing to question it, being willing to stop it, being willing to see the space around this ego is the only way out of the egotistical mind. Oh, one of the things... developing the good qualities that I talked about, Buddhism being ego development. I might mention that Freud called developing the perfect ego, he called an ideal fiction, in that you're never going to do it. You're never going to develop your mind free of all imperfections. Thoughts, comments, questions before we head off for our Friday night sessions in wherever it is? Yeah. So the ego and the e-guy. So e-guy sounds like the guy who fixes your computer.
and that's the higher self, the divine inside of us.
Hopefully you're all a little bit less inclined to see the ego as a, in the common sense. I mean, we don't have to stick to Freud's definition of ego, but I think it's very useful to see what he meant when he was talking about egos. And that both in Freudian psychology and in Buddhism, we're supposed to develop the ego. It's not something that you get rid of. I actually did a talk on ego in Vietnam to a bunch of business people, and afterwards they had questions. And the first woman, she was looking after her father, so she wanted to control her father's ego so that she'd be happier. Second question was a man who felt his daughter didn't have enough ego, and he wanted to give her a bigger ego. And then the third question was a guy who wanted to stop his father controlling the business because he was supposed to be taking over. And he's saying, my father's too egotistical, how can I stop him? And at this point, I stopped the questions and answers and said, this isn't about working on other people's egos. It's about working on your own ego. And you will never fix everybody else's ego so that your passage through the world is smooth. You can only fix your own ego. Then your passage through the world will be smooth. And if you need to illustrate in a story, because stories are there to illustrate principles, I remember the queen who left the palace and she stubbed her toe on a rock. And she said to her minister, will you please cover my entire kingdom with leather so that I will not stub my toe again? And the minister said, Your Majesty, maybe we could just cover your foot with leather instead of the entire kingdom. And that was how shoes got invented. But this is what we're trying to do. We want to solve everybody else's ego. How to win friends and influence people. Make friends and influence yourself and everyone else will be okay.
Yeah, thank you. It is between the thoughts. Then you feel, I don't really want the martial arts.
Yes, okay, if you were practicing with that marshmallow, it's a topic of another talk, but the way that the teaching goes is you see the arising of the desire, you can see the cessation of the desire, you can see the satisfaction that would be gained from following that desire, you see the danger that would be in following that desire, and you see the escape. And I was actually going to talk about that tonight, but didn't have time. The arising of the desire is samudaya arising. The cessation of that desire is atangama, which is not a word I'm familiar with, atangama. Cessation of that desire. The satisfaction that would be in the things, because we, although we say something might be suffering, we also recognize that there's satisfaction in it too. Satisfaction in the things is called the asada. The misery or the danger involved in following after things is called the adinawa. And the escape from it is called the nitsarana, the escape or the refuge. So this is the cycle that as monks we get trained in. We're supposed to see this cycle with our desires. And if you see all of these five aspects, then wisdom starts to arise by itself. Yeah. But it'd be a little bit much to get the kids to do that. Yeah.
You know, the rational model and the ego. Yeah. Sometimes for me, or in the past, I think I kind of thought we were getting something at the end.
Right.
It was more of a kind of a journey.
The Buddha put it this way, he said, right now in this present moment, am I developing a good quality or not? And so then, to my mind, that becomes quite clear what I need to do. And sometimes that appears to be goal-orientated too. You know, I want to open a center in Bangkok in September, it's a goal. But moment to moment, I'm just trying to develop a good quality. And you know, you could be a little bit careful with some people who practice Buddhism. It's like, oh, I'm so in the present moment and I'm so let go. And then you just don't do anything. And that's not good either. And I did that for 4 years when I ordained. I just let go, let go, let go, let go. And after 4 years, it's like, I think I've let go now. and well, maybe I should do something. And I recognize in myself it wasn't good to just float around the monastery anymore. So I moved temples into Bangkok and I went to university. But to me that was developing a good quality too. Friday night's calling, so we'll leave it there. Thank you all for coming. It's very nice to see you all. Do remember to support Bodhi Tree with a few dollars, the price of a coffee at least, to help Mai with her enormous mortgage that she has on this building. That it does have expenses, so small acts of kindness actually go a long way.